ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan. He's back in the house on the ABC Cricket Podcast. Oh, they're always my favourite episodes. He's sort of just getting a little freshened up during this this IPL window as we get through the season of autumn. With winter fast approaching, he's ready to lock back in for all your cricket analysis. Hello, Teddy.
Corb, I'm a real long-form podcaster, aren't I?
You are.
Not long-form in the podcast.
Mm.
Long-form cricket podcaster.
You are.
I haven't watched any IPL.
None?
No. I've been using this time to really freshen the mind. And then I come in hot. Then I've got my mind, you know, and thoughts all aligned on what to do, and here we are.
How about Ben Cameron messaged me the other night? He was turned on the IPL randomly and just was after a Friday night game or whatever it was. And the first thing he saw was Cam Green's bat getting measured, got put through the thing, and his bat was too big for essentially he had to go and get another stick. Oh, that's not something you see every day, but that's what's going on over at the IPL is measuring the size of people's bats and everything else. Great. That's what they're doing over there. That's what they're doing over there.
That usually happens, just a quick insight, inside a change room. So, you know, if the match referee will come round pre-game and just check bats.
Yeah.
So occasionally it happens on the field if something looks a bit off, but that is, it's like almost there's been a tip-off. Someone's dialed the Big Bat hotline and said, you need to go measure Cam Green's bat.
Correct.
It looks a bit wide or a bit thick. How funny.
There's been a fair bit going on, Teddy, in the cricket universe.
Last week
I was chatting with the head of the Players Association and, 24 hours after that was released, whole thing's off. It's a big pause button hit on the privatisation of the BBL. Did you catch the Paul Marsh episode?
I did. I thought it was some of your best work.
Oh.
Paul was excellent.
He is.
And I gave that feedback. I mean, clear, direct, thoughtful. You got to remember, this is someone who has grown up inside Australian cricket, cares so deeply about it, and it plays out, you know, in how well, you know, he brought the ACA through, you know, some pretty formative years, and now again at a bit of an interesting juncture. But a couple of things I took away, and you know the joy about Paul Marsh, and he's a friend of mine. And the best kind of friends are the ones that you can disagree with.
Yep.
You can give your view, and you at the end you have a hug and a glass of wine, and there's no, you know, like we don't agree on everything, and we talk in private about these things. And a few people say, "Oh, did you hear what Pug said on the podcast?" I was like, "I'm sure it's nothing that he hasn't said to my face."
Yep.
And it's all fine. And you know he's a. You got to remember his sole job is to do what's best by the players. And the Players Association is a union, essentially, and has brought the playing conditions and the earnings power of the players from nothing to significant, has done an amazing job. And this is where we kind of differ in our opinions. And, you know, Paul made a laugh. I always find it funny that players, you know, want to change a system that was so good to them. It was amazing to me. But I finished playing over 10 years ago. There was no T10 league in the UAE. There was no Sri Lankan T20. There was no Caribbean league. The IPL existed. There was no 100. There was no SA20. It was Big Bash and the IPL. So the world has changed. And this is kind of where we diverge in our views. And my view is that the current model is not really that fit for purpose. It needs to change. And there are some outputs of that. But even right down to the basics, we both believe that the best players should be paid more.
Yeah.
Where you know, he's, as he should be in his role, you know, very focused on you know what you described aptly is that middle class or lower middle class of cricketer. And all I guess where I say is we should be trading off money for flexibility or you know opportunity maybe for those players because the current model of being essentially paid up front, really. You know, Cricket Australia earns money and it goes straight to pay the players in a proportion. It works up to a certain point and then it breaks. And it's now breaking the system. And so we need to find a way to delay the gratification of the players, incentivize them on in different ways, still so that their total compensation is significant and growing largely. But there needs to be more incentive to be great, and there needs to be more incentive to grow the game together. Because if you're only going on revenue, unfortunately, the way the game is now set up and the revenue drivers of the game, it wasn't thought of at the time when the MOU was very thoughtfully put together. So we disagree. There's no problem in that. I mean, he articulates a great case. I feel like I can articulate a equally compelling case. Doesn't mean we have to agree. And there needs to be, I think, some middle ground. And hopefully, I mean, I'm not on any side here. I'm just an observer. I don't work for Cricket Australia. I don't work for the Players Association.
He's a great man to represent you, isn't he? Like, if you're the players, you'd be pretty chuffed to have him in your corner. But
he's an absolute bulldog.
Yeah, rather than the redistribution of the total sum, which is basically how like a salary cap or anything like that works in any other sports league. Essentially, hey, if you've got a sensational player that deserves to be the best paid player in the competition, if it's in the AFL or whatever it turns out to be, then he is that. But it means you got less money to go around for everyone else. So then you got to have a bunch of other guys that are on below what the average salary turns out to be. So. I like what Paul's doing, though. He's basically saying, hey, we're happy with the fat middle class, and then we also want more money so we can pay the best players even more on top of that, where you think, well,
Then that's where I think it breaks down. We're talking male and female here, and one drives a significant portion of revenue and the other is a growing and increasingly important area of the game, but is out of kilter with, the wage inflation is out of kilter with the revenue growth in inflation.
Even domestic cricket, outside of the Big Bash compared to international cricket, for example, like in the men's game, like some of the salaries guys are on to play, Shield cricket and One Day Cup in front of two men and a dog.
100%. Yeah. And I'd be interested in the analysis. If you thought, I'm sure there's a cohort of players, and we're kind of diverging a little bit here, but it's kind of interesting to me, so it might be interesting to you and listeners. There's like a cohort, and I don't know the stats, but I'm kind of hypothesizing. A cohort of players that get paid well, that play, I don't know, sub 10 days of cricket a year professionally, as in first team, not second team, not development, actual elite competition, they're squad members. So sub 10 days. Mm. I would be interested on what their per day rate is compared to the best players. Because if that is equal, or in some cases it might even be more, that makes no sense to me.
Yep.
And so how do we find maybe the squads are too? I don't know what the answer is, but I'd love to see the data actually, and even the bottom half of salaries across domestic and Big Bash, what is the number of days those people play on average, and how does that compare to the other half? I think it would work better in probably quartiles. I think half would probably not work, but I think it'd be interesting.
And then down the other end, are you happy to lose the next star of Australian cricket that might need a couple of years in the system, essentially, who goes and plays rugby league or Aussie rules or whatever it turns out to be, because there's 900 jobs or whatever it turns out to be?
So I don't. I don't believe in this, and I actually haven't for a while, because the war on talent, or for talent rather, is such a, I think it's a bit of a bogeyman. And yes, there'll always be people who, are great at both sports. So in my age group, for instance, Braithen Astor was a very strong cricketer. Very strong cricketer. Could have played professional cricket. He chose rugby league. Why? Because at the time, he got signed as a 16-year-old, 17-year-old to the Bulldogs. And so there will always be that player, or Alex Carey or whatever. But that was in a time when cricket didn't have these mega money potential. And there's more flexibility. So that's in an environment in Australia. If you want to play cricket, it is a global game, and you can out-earn 10, 50 times the best AFL player or the best rugby league player. So it's up to the player to determine, what do I love and what do I want to do?
Yeah.
Because no longer can you say, oh, there are more. That just means you want to be average. Oh, I just want to be a professional AFL player. And do what? So I just don't I don't understand that. Oh, there are more jobs.
It's an easier path. Like, if you're on the bubble and you're on the fringe or whatever, like, it's easier to make it as a fringe player in the AFL than it is to make it as a fringe player in domestic cricket.
That shouldn't be the, that we should not be providing that incentive for anyone.
No.
Let's try and create enough jobs so that we get lots of fringe players. We're trying to find the best.
Of course.
And usually you know who those best players are by the time they are 17, 18, 19, or probably not even 17, 19 or 20. And they've either gone to play AFL or not, or they want to play cricket and be a global superstar. Like, it's not a trade-off.
But if you become like a very competitive domestic cricketer, like we've seen a few of those in the last decade or whatever, that probably, you know, out-earn a lot of AFL players or whatever, you know, there's money to be had for those guys. Whereas in your new world, if you were to thin that out, there's not the same money to be made there. And what you're essentially doing is helping the whole ecosystem of Australian cricket by being a really good, you know, first-class cricketer or whatever it turns out to be to help all these other guys coming through. Whereas if you slash that, then all of a sudden your first-class system's less competitive. You're basically saying, hey, if you're not in the mix to play for Australia or sign up for an IPL team.
I think you misunderstand me. The very best first-class cricketers deserve to be paid well because they are important to the ecosystem. What I'm trying to avoid is the bottom 20% who are fringe players who still get paid very well.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you can find some kind of funnel, but maybe we need to look at how we move people through the funnel. Like, let's actually, that's what I've said this a couple of times. What does a blank piece of paper look like from an entire MOU point of view? And it might end up looking something like this, but if you start with what you've got at the moment, it's very hard to change it. If that's your mentor, well, this is the minimum that we're going to take is what we've already got. Well, then what you got is what you got.
The only other thing is to the, you know, you're looking at it now very much as a wise guy that's been around for a long period of time and understands how this works. Think about what you were thinking about when you were 17, 18 or whatever it turns out to be. And you sort of, it can happen overnight for you at 17 to 18 in the AFL. Whereas in cricket, as we know, a lot of guys don't play their best cricket until they're, past the age of 25 or whatever it turns out to be. It's, you got to have a longer horizon to sort of think, what you might become and what it looks like. Whereas in, you can be running around in front of 100,000 at the MCG, next year if you're in the final year of school.
So, sure. And I guess my final point is the crossover is so small. How many players?
Yeah, that is fair.
We're talking about maybe 10 players every 5 years.
Yeah.
I don't know what the number is, but it's not every talented cricketer is an amazing AFL or NRL player.
Yeah, Steve Smith wasn't going to play for the Sydney Swans or the Newcastle Knights or anything, was he?
I've seen him kick a ball. That is fact.
That's an interesting side street we went down. But the way into it was to talk about the huge week that it's been for Australian cricket, obviously, on the privatisation front. So we've got the big pause button that has been hit. It has been fascinating the way that it's all panned out. You've really been running the conversation here, Teddy. And for people that are listeners of this pod, you know that a couple of weeks ago after it was reported that it was 5-1 in terms of where the states were voting, you did make the point at the time. You said, hey, keep in mind, by the way, that two of those have huge caveats on them in Queensland and South Australia, and really the only thing that changed is that Queensland turned their sign around. So from open to close, they basically said, hey, we're now officially a no. And then the next thing we learned from Cricket Australia is that the whole thing's off for now. So we've got a big pause button hit on privatisation when it comes to the BBL.
Give me the outside in view. I'm curious on your view as to both the events and how they unplayed. And just for clarity, a yes with a laundry list of caveats is not a yes. That's a no.
Yep.
And so when it's easy to report and say South Australia was a yes, but there were caveats, that's a no. Because a model was put forward and you either signed up to the model or not. And so that's a no.
So New South Wales would have been technically a yes to privatisation, wouldn't they?
Yeah, exactly.
With all your caveats, Matt.
That's it. Everyone's a yes with caveats.
Yep. What's my view? My view is there was too many holes in it. That in the end, there was too many questions being asked from too many stakeholders. I mean, even chatting with Paul Marsh last week for 25 minutes or whatever, you're like, wow, like these guys have a heap of things they need to work through. And that's just to get an MOU done, which at the end of it would result in more money for the players. So these are guys that are going to be huge benefactors, you would think, of this coming in. And even they were sitting there saying, hey, there's a whole lot to work through before we push ahead with this. You expressed a similar view with me on multiple occasions over the past couple of weeks. And basically, I think Cricket Australia were just too light on for details, that essentially they'd Yeah, I felt like they were losing the argument, not just with the broader cricket community, but they were losing the argument with their key stakeholders. And without them on board, it was never going to advance to the next step. So, I mean, my only concern is, at the end of the day, that they've still going to have a bottom line that they're going to have to try and meet. They've had less test days than what they were hoping for in the Ashes. They made a loss the year before that when India came. And they basically spent the last 2.5 months trying to get something off the ground, which ultimately isn't going to happen. So what does that mean now for the next season and the season after that and the knock-on effect for all the states when all this time and energy has basically been poured into something which isn't going to get off the ground?
Oh, how do I unpick that? I mean...
What about answering your own question then, Teddy? So what was your rate on the events of the last week?
Where to start? Okay, maybe it's worth just setting the record straight on New South Wales cricket's point of view because, you know, I read a few things in the press and it was interesting to see how the press almost turned against the privatisation more broadly. You know, basically all papers were... And the comments, if you read the comments and the Instagrams and the state organisations are member organisations at the end of the day. And there's been overwhelming support from Cricket New South Wales members, I know, you know, of the position, which, you know, got positioned as community cuts and more revenue because of gambling. And that wasn't it at all. What the position was we agree with a lot of the recommendations in the BCG report, and we'll get to those in a second. And we feel as though there's a better way to achieve those recommendations, which involved running the business better, so more revenue, less cost. And there's a whole range of different revenue, you know, levers you can pull, one of which was product fees. But that's predicated on the fact that cricket is already involved in gambling. And so either as a major sponsor or product fees or whatever that is, it was just a point that we're not achieving all that we can as a game. So if we don't want to be in betting, that's fine. Cricket New South Wales is happy with that position. One of our major sponsors is a anti-gambling government campaign.
Yep.
So the point is, let's have that debate, but also that there's costs to be taken out, and Cricket Australia had committed to take out costs as part of this process. Well, let's accelerate that, because I live in a world of, you know, looking at public and private companies, and CFOs are waking up every morning and finding millions of dollars in savings since in this new world of AI and automation. So there are more savings to be had, and that does not mean cutting community cricket. That means there's duplications across states and Cricket Australia. That means roles and responsibilities could be done more cleanly and being a little bit more focused as cricket in Australia, not just Cricket Australia or Cricket New South Wales. It's like whole of cricket. There are ways to fund, let's call it, $100 million over 5 years. Whether or not cricket needs $100 million to reset the Big Bash, let's just assume that's the number. And so what are the takeouts here? What have the states said, or three states have essentially said, so it's not a Cricket New South Wales issue, three states have basically said the same thing. And that is the recommendations are clear. Let's reset the Big Bash. Let's get the best player. How do we do that? Let's get the best players. Let's get a window. And let's ensure that the Big Bash is sufficiently invested in to ensure that happens. What are the other recommendations? Governance change. It's very murky at the moment. Cricket decisions and commercial decisions are all kind of woven through the fabric of Australian cricket. Let's find a better way to ensure the game is governed. Because if anything this process has shown is that the governance is no longer fit for purpose either. And so let's think about that. Let's think about the players. So, you know, player payments, not just the best players playing, but the best players being paid more so that they want to play. Let's fix the MOU. So what are the states saying? They're saying, let's do things in the order that is a bit more natural than let's go sell teams and then work it all out later, which is kind of your point. Let's get all these things in place, the governance, the MOU, the window. Let's invest some money in the Big Bash to make it better. And then at that point in time, make a clean decision. You have more data from the 100, and then let's, if needed, let's have the conversation.
It's been an extraordinary episode, though, isn't it? That so you lay that all out, and that all sounds completely reasonable. How was it not approached in that order to begin with? Like, how does it end up here, where it's like, oh, hang on, there's too many holes, we're going to pause it? Like, it's a...
Yeah, I don't want to cast aspersions, but it feels as though they were running a rerun of the 100. And that's kind of, but totally different situation. Counties needed money, high debt, infrastructure costs, whatever that is. And so it was just easy. It was an easy way. And there's problems with that 100 process, by the way. But it's just, it's the old cookie cutter. And their advisor, their main advisor, Rain, cookie cuttered it in. And it's not how Australian cricket works under the guise of co-design. There was no real co-design. There was no co-design here with the states. There was consultation at times, but no real co-design. And so I guess what the states are saying is, let's actually do this together to work out what is needed.
You really have seven major stakeholders, though. You have the six states and the players.
Yeah.
And I mean, to be honest, what I'm as baffled about as anything is that, you know, Cricket Australia sort of ran down this past as gleefully as they did, you know, without addressing any of the holes in it. How the hell were the other states that voted yes categorically in the position that they were? Like for Victoria and WA and Tasmania to essentially say, yep, no worries, away we go. So let's you know, look at the, yeah, and you never can prove the counterfactual, but say it goes down that path and everyone votes the same way they did, and then we got all these issues and essentially we're off selling to, you know, Indian billionaires and everything else who are coming in and running Australian cricket, and they've just taken this position, you know, without any of the same questions that at least South Australia, Queensland and New South Wales did.
Yeah, I mean, and all in different situations. You know, the WACA have just redeveloped their ground, put a nice little water park in. The cost of that has caused a little bit of debt to flow through the system. And so when you have a capital structure or debt that increases the need for short-term decision-making,
incredible,
you're not thinking about what's happening with your player pathways. You're thinking as a chair or a board member, we need to get rid of X amount, and it's a lot,
incredible,
of debt. And so you're not thinking straight. It's easy to see how they were probably murky in their thinking.
Incredible.
Tassie have a new stadium to build for the AFL and cricket. And so you can see how a little bit of private capital and, you know, there are certain IPL owners that own infrastructure assets and that could. So their mind starts thinking about what's best for their state, and I'm not in those rooms, so I'm just kind of putting a lens on it. And Victoria, I don't know. I think the Renegades are an absolute basket case, and so this is a way to kind of wipe their hands clean. But why not, in the interim, say, okay, the Renegades are going to play the MCG, we're going to find ways to actually create something, or we move it, or so there are other options rather than wanting to drive a sale. Because I know a lot of people in and around Victorian cricket that weren't keen, and you just don't know what happens behind closed doors.
To be honest, like as someone that doesn't know as much about this, but just chatting to you and other people in and around Australian cricket, and people have been able to hear a lot of those conversations in the last couple of weeks, feels like a big bullet dodged with so much to work through that we're in this position. I guess the big question is, what happens now? The fallout from all of it. I mean, first of all, the juicy sort of media storyline is clearly around Mike Baird as the chairman of Cricket Australia and his relationship with New South Wales Cricket, obviously a board in which you sit on. He's the incoming chief executive at NRMA, which is a deal which starts in August of 2026. Now, Cricket Australia are insisting that, you know, he's not leaving, he's going to stay on as the chair. I don't know. Put your finger in the wind. It feels like it's a long time between now and the start of next summer with all of this as the backdrop. Yeah, Baird's role in the whole situation has been that, yeah, he's been reportedly very keen on privatisation and how much, yeah, his personal view has had to do with this push from Cricket Australia and the path that they've decided to go down as a business and a whole of cricket decision that's basically been tied up into this. I guess they can say what they want. I don't know if you're going to give us any more insight on it, but it... Geez, it feels like a long time between the now and the start of next cricket season to think that everything's going to stay exactly the same way it is.
Yeah, look, it depends. I mean, cricket is lucky to have someone of Mike Baird's calibre, and he's done an amazing job around a whole range of issues in Australian cricket. If you think about the capability increase, you know, at head office, there are some great people there, including Todd and Ed Sanders, the new head of commercial, who are, you know, driving outcomes. The place is moving forward. And that's the chair's role is to get the right people in the right seats or help support that. You can see when the press say, oh, his role's now untenable. I don't believe that to be true.
So is his relationship with New South Wales cricket retrievable from here?
Absolutely. There needs to be a conversation, no doubt, that hasn't been had around ultimately he is Cricket New South Wales representative. But that's just a conversation as to where to from here. Can we do this together? Can we collaborate? If the answer's no, I don't know, and I have no idea of the answer, well, then you've got an issue. But you have to have the conversation.
Because it feels you could understand that they would look at New South Wales and think, you guys stop this from happening.
Well, no. What do you mean? Not solely. Half the states thought the same.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a... That's why I think it's unfair saying Cricket New South Wales, it was far from. We were just a little crisper in how we delivered it.
Yeah. Do you think if you were a soft yes like they were with all these caveats, do you think Cricket Australia would have forced it through, knowing the way that it was reported that it was 5-1?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that would have been possible.
Mm. Well, it felt like you guys were the only outlier, and now all of a sudden it's emerged that, oh, actually there was a couple of others. And
So what I will pick up is... You know, that governance change issue, and it's not a personnel issue. It's a how, you know, from a Cricket Australia point of view, there are current representatives, but maybe we go back to, you know, there are two situations. One is there is a state board member on the Cricket Australia board, and there are some independents, and then you have a separate model of a commercial co or the Big Bash co or whatever. You set up a separate structure to which Cricket Australia also has three representatives, but you have domain experts, commercial domain experts, sitting on that board to drive outcomes for cricket in Australia more broadly. And so you can then get to a situation where the states, rather than this situation we're in, where you kind of go around and you try and gain the support, or is it already at the board level? You know that because your board member is sitting there. And so if it doesn't get out of the Cricket Australia boardroom, it doesn't come to the states. There's no need.
This is chicken and the egg type stuff, isn't it, when it comes to the way cricket's operated for many years, where, you know, Cricket Australia and people that run the game basically say, hey, we've got to do this independently of the states because the states can never agree on everything and they've always got self-interest at heart and everything else. And yet, as we found in this case, without the support of the states, you can't get anything done anyway. So you're basically in exactly the same position. So I understand, like, when you first put that forward, I thought, oh yeah, how's that going to go? You know, someone from each state sitting around a boardroom or whatever. But ultimately, you end up in the same position, don't you? Without all of them, on the journey together.
Yeah, and part of this process, I've been exposed to a few other state chair people. They are super high caliber. You know, there are some high caliber people.
No doubt.
In Australian cricket, Will Rayner comes to mind. And South Australia's view is pretty pure. They don't need the money. You know, they have this other model where the SACA membership, you know, is incredibly beneficial to their bottom line and their cash flow. And so they have the ability to be very pure in their thinking. And Will has been a thought leader in this and definitely thought his way through it to get to the position that South Australia got to. So there are lots of good people who could be contributing in a governance model that could definitely, you know, function, I think. I don't know what's right or wrong here. I'm kind of spitballing a little bit.
Mm. Kirsten Park?
Yeah, excellent.
So I guess the next step now, so essentially do they continue down this path and sort out all those issues that you outlined earlier, and then this happens over the winter months, and if it takes until this time next year or the year after or whatever turns out to be?
Or the year after, let's find out.
Will they continue down that path, or will it just be parked now and put into a bottom drawer somewhere and we'll worry about it down the track?
I think it will keep popping up. I don't think this is, you know, a dead, buried, put your tombstone on the grave kind of situation, because the international landscape is going to continually change and you're going to have more information.
So what was the point of the announcement last week to basically say, hey, the timeline that we had is now no longer relevant?
Correct.
Yeah.
So let's see. I don't know where to from here. That's a question above my pay grade, I think they say.
I guess the other part that's been put forward in all of this as part of the scaremongering campaign is everything else is cuts to community cricket. Everyone should expect, you know, a few million less in the budget and everything else when it comes around next time. So what do you say to all that now that this huge financial boon's not coming to the game, obviously, at least in the short term? What's it going to mean for cricket in the summer of 26-27, for example, from a state-based level and the flow-on effect from there?
Well, the state funding isn't changing. In actual fact, it should go up in line with inflation. So there's no reason, unless a state decides to cut its community funding, because that's where it flows through, I'd expect there'd be no changes.
So if there's a shortfall, and say Cricket Australia didn't make as much out of the last summer, which they've been very guarded about at this stage, but ultimately that'll come out down the track.
I'm unsure the shortfall's all that was pitched.
Well,
but
we
also,
two
it depends what you want to do with Big Bash. You've got to remember, so that's the swing factor. If you want to invest for growth, the current status is very manageable. It's a question of whether you then want to find an extra $20 or $30 million to invest in the Big Bash.
Because we know where the money's coming from. The TV deal's done. Essentially, the distribution doesn't change. And then it's the only thing that basically is going to change is if they want to put more money into the BBL, where are they getting that money from?
That is correct.
Okay. There we go. It's a good breakdown as to... Because it feels like that was part of
a lot of talking. I'm sorry, Corb.
No, but that's...
I didn't even give you a chance to ask questions.
That's the part, though, that's been sold, though, isn't it? It's very much like, hey, community cricket's going to miss out if we don't do this.
States are laser-focused on community cricket. 5 to 12-year-olds. Like, it is... That's the purpose.
Yeah.
Is to get to people to play and love the game, and that starts when you're 5 years old.
Mm. How old? I'm fascinated what the knock-on effect's going to be, because, I mean, surely if you pour this much time and attention into something for 2 months and then you basically decide, hey, we're not going to do it, at least in the short term, I don't know.
Oh,
that's
sure there's
it's
lots
time
of
where
people...
you haven't got your eyes on other areas.
Oh, for sure. I'm sure there are lots of people at Cricket Australia who are feeling beaten up, disengaged. You know, like, it'd be a real kick in the guts, but, that's life, and, it would have been a huge distraction for some people from their core job, and they would have put a lot of time and energy in, and I feel pretty empathetic to that, having seen deals fall over the whole time. So we'll see where it gets to.
Yeah, but the position you guys took wasn't one of hey, we want to be disruptive. It's basically that we genuinely don't believe this is the right thing for the game and at this particular
right
period
model.
Of time.
Yeah, that's correct.
Todd Greenberg's actually going to join me next week here on the pod. So
I'll let you sort those questions out. I don't want to be associated with that.
That's good time.
Tell him that I have had nothing to do with your preparation.
What, other than chatting to you every single week here? I'll put a few of those things to him next week, and I'll see if we can get to the next stage, sort of clear stuff up from the other side of the fence. I thought it was interesting too, by the way. You got a pretty good insight into the modern state of the cricket media, didn't you, as to who was on message and who wasn't during this whole process, as to, hey, these is the guys getting the Cricket Australia sort of briefings on the way through, and here's the other side of the fence and people that are perhaps chatting to others and making their own mind up.
Yeah. I mean, there was, Gideon is always brilliant, but when he gets an inkling on something is...
Yeah. It smells.
The power,
doesn't
of, the pen,
quite
the power
smell
of the pen
right.
is real. Yeah, that's right.
Man. But then some of the other, I heard plenty of people saying, "Oh, we got to do it. We got to do privatisation." It's like, okay, why? we didn't need too many sort of really solid, concrete explanations on that front. Should we chat about other things going on in cricket? Is there anything else going on in cricket?
The IPL's going on. Maybe you can give a little rundown. Did you see the Royals got sold?
To Lakshmi Mittal. So the Mittal family purchased, who's a basically UK-based, Indian-born steel magnate, for $1.65 billion is the sale of the Rajasthan Royals.
US.
Yeah. I find it fascinating too, Teddy. This happens mid-tournament. So it's basically, imagine waking up playing for Rajasthan and, right, someone else owns the team today.
It doesn't quite happen like that, but...
It's pretty much.
That in and of itself is interesting. Imagine a future where an IPL team owns a Big Bash team and the ownership structure changes at the IPL level, and all of a sudden your state association deal with a new owner as well. And they were like, oh, we have all these controls in place to make sure our relationship's good. And then,
never met this person.
Who's this person?
A dude in the UK that all of a sudden owns the team. You got to go meet him and work out that he now owns some team in Perth that plays out of the Wacker or whatever it is. Or Perth Stadium. So the tournament is well and truly up and running. Australia have 16 players over in the IPL, but there's five of them we're yet to see. So Spencer Johnson, Ben Dorschus, Mitch Owen, Jack Edwards and Josh Inglis haven't played a game. In fairness to Josh Inglis, he's behind a guy named Richard Punt, who's currently got the gloves at the moment for Lucknow. So of the 16 that are there, 11 are playing. Of those 11, only 6 have played every game. So Marsh, Head, Green, Connolly, Stoinis and David. I feel a bit for Cam Green at the moment. So he had a nice knock. He's on big bucks. Obviously well documented the fact that he's struggling in the national team. It feels like there's a bit of confirmation bias going on in the media at the moment that sort of when he goes well, we don't hear about it. And when he struggles, we do because it suits the narrative. And the storyline at the moment is, hey, Cam Green's overrated, blah, blah, blah. And that feels like that's very, you know, the mainstream kind of lens on him. At least he's there. He's playing. He's in the best cricket competition in the world. His numbers are fine, yeah, better than some of the others in the tournament so far. So he's played all 9 games, averages 28 at a strike rate of 151. He's got 3 wickets for the tournament. If you look at some of the other guys that are over there, that puts him middle of the road to slightly above average when it comes to the Australian representation that we've had in the IPL so far.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we touched on a couple of weeks ago for sure. I think you're right. The Cooper Connolly narrative is interesting to me. The fact that, you know, he's playing every game in the IPL.
Yeah.
He played a match-winning innings not so long ago. Like, this is someone who's now getting exposure to the best competition in the world. And we are beneficiaries of that for sure from a national team point of view. The kid can play, and we're going to see that come through in the coming years.
It's been for people that follow the IPL and respect it, and I'm certainly one of those. Yeah, it's reinforced why he's been getting the opportunities he has been in the national team, hasn't it? I mean, he's playing under Ricky Ponting's tutelage there with the Punjab Kings. So he's played all 9 games, 250s, averaging 38 at a strike rate of 167. Just on a couple of the other guys and how they're going. So Matt Short's only played the 2 games. He got 1 score in the 30s and then missed out in the other. Mitch Stark's only played 1 game. He's coming back from shoulder and elbow issues, but it was the last game. So hopefully he gets a run at it here. Picked up 3 wickets playing for Delhi. Josh Hazlewood's played 6 of the 9 games so far. He's got 8 wickets at 8 and over. Tim David's played all 9 games. He's got 192 runs off 100 balls, which gives him a strike rate of 192, Teddy. Stoinis has played all 9 games.
Easy for your maths there, big man.
Stoinis has played all 9 games, 6 innings, 3 times he's been not out. He's striking at 189 and going at 11 with the ball. And Xavier Bartlett's played 8 of the 9 games for the Kings as well. He's taken 5 wickets at 11 and over. To the Sunrisers, Hyderabad, Pat Cummins is back. He got knocked around the park, it must be said, the other day by Suryavanshi. I don't know if you saw, he got that blistering 100. 3 games, he's got only 2 wickets going at 9.5 and over. Travis Head's played all 10 games, averaging 32. He's got 2 half centuries. Mitch Marsh has played all 8 for Lucknow, averaging 26 with 150. So there's a couple of the Australians and how they're going at the moment over there in the IPL. Just in the competition more broadly, so probably the thing that's most surprising about this year's IPL, Jasper Bumrah, who can't buy a wicket. He's got 3 wickets at 94 for the tournament, and he's going at almost 9 and over. So has the bubble finally burst, Teddy, on the greatness of Jasper Bumrah after tearing apart the T20 World Cup and all of a sudden battling in the IPL, something we so rarely see from him?
I'm first putting my hand up and say I haven't watched enough to comment more broadly, but that is fascinating, isn't it? You know what? I'll commit. When am I next on? A couple of weeks.
Yep.
I'll commit to a little bit of
Jasper deep dive.
Not just Jasper. I'll put some IPL time in. I only have a certain number of cricket brain hours a week, and the last couple of weeks have been taken up by Big Bash. And so now I can switch my attention, and I promise you I'll come back with something on the IPL.
Abhishek Sharma, leading run scorer, so he had a lean T20 World Cup, but he's back amongst it as we've come to expect in recent years. And little shout out to Peshawar, who of course beat the Hyderabad Kingsmen in the PSL. So Aaron Hardy started in the final there, so he took 4 wickets, unbeaten half century, made 56 knots. So good on them. Leading run scorer in the tournament was Babar Azam. Interesting to note. Strike rate of 145.
I did see.
Steve Smith was top 5 for runs. Glenn Maxwell struggled, so averaged only 14. He scored 99 runs, but he scored 70 of them in one hit. So he scored 29 in the other 7. So it's just not happening for Maxie, unfortunately, at the moment in the shortest version of the game.
How many cricketers across the IPL and PSL were there in total?
Aussies?
Hmm.
I can find out for you.
I guess my point, you know, like it goes back to just to create full circle. The ecosystem of international cricket has changed so much. You know, when we go back to the MOU, these opportunities were not apparent across what a cohort of, let's call it, there's probably 30 players playing overseas at the moment.
So 15 in the PSL and 16 in the, yeah, so 31 and 16 in the IPL. So 31 in those two competitions alone. And that says nothing, by the way, of all the guys that are over in the UK at the moment.
Yeah. So anyway, food for thought.
Some listener questions before we get out of here. This is from our man Teddy G. Teddy G is 11 years old. It says,
Teddy G, my fave.
Hi Corb and Teddy, I'm 11 years old. I love my cricket. I play for the Seaforth Bashers. I love your pod. Great to listen to when I want to tune into the cricket world and get a very well thought view on it from you guys. I find the BBL privatisation very interesting. So you'll enjoy today's episode, Teddy G. This, based on listening to you guys, I'm happy there is a pause on the deadline. From Teddy G.
Teddy G, you're a legend. Thanks for listening. I mean, I always forget that we have, you know, a lot of dads listen and stick it on the cars, and the kids just have to listen along, and you never know if the kids like it or not. Good to hear from one Ted to another.
It's more a PG podcast, Teddy. We
are PG. I don't, you know,
watch our P's and Q's.
Keep your potty mouth out of the chat.
All right, let's go, Jackson. What do you think of Renshaw or McSweeney at number 5 now there's a spot available? And do you think Xavier Bartlett or Spencer Johnson will have a test career? From Jackson.
Jeez, that's a direct question out of season, isn't it? What do I think of Renshaw or McSweeney? I mean, both could do that job. Both are top order players.
Is there a spot available? So you think Usman goes out. I would say everyone just moves up one and they...
Yeah, you're probably right, actually.
Yeah, and so...
No spot available. I'll dodge the question for the moment and say no spot available.
If you had to pick Renshaw or McSweeney, who have you got on top as it stands at the moment?
Renshaw.
And Spencer Johnson needs to play some Red Bull cricket.
He's going to get in the park.
Yeah, let's worry about that when he gets out there. Xavier Bartlett's...
Excellent cricket.
Yeah, we like him. Alec in Melbourne. I'm moving to San Diego in a month. With both of you in the US regularly, what's the best way to catch cricket over there?
I thought he was going to say, do you want to have a scooey? Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, sounds great in San Diego. I mean, I'm lucky enough to get over there a little bit and have to keep following. So these are good. So a couple of things that I've found. One, you need the ABC Listen app. And this is not a promotion, but you can't download it if you're in the US. It's geo-blocked, but you download it before and it works. So I remember listening to Corbin and Xavier from Hobart commentating the Australia-New Zealand test while I was in San Francisco working. That was awesome. So you get the ABC Listen app and you get live commentary for all the Aussie games and blah, blah, blah. If you want vision, you need to, and I don't know if I can say this on an ABC podcast, but Willow TV. So you subscribe to Willow TV. It's like a local streaming service and they have all the games from around the world and that's excellent.
Jackson, it's a different Jackson. The ACA spoke about the risk of losing young athletes to other sports if cricket can't compete financially. But doesn't BBL privatisation risk the loss of potential players to Shield cricket by incentivising the next gen to abandon the long form for the cash of T20 cricket?
I mean, Jackson, that incentive has been at play for some time now and is only increasing. So I think it's true, but it's not true that that would automatically happen with privatisation. There is a strong incentive to both have a Big Bash contract and a Shield contract. And if you could only choose one, you'd probably choose just a Big Bash contract.
Gareth says, can you foresee any conflict of interest issues if players take ownership stakes in the BBL teams?
No, I think that's a great idea and something that I'm definitely keen to explore. You know, you think of how employees are incentivized at companies. There's some employee option plan and you have some kind of equity pool. And so why wouldn't you encourage your best players? And let's take the Strikers, for example. Travis, your two local homegrown heroes, build them a statue players, Carey and Head. Why wouldn't you say, hey, we'll pay you X, but part of your contract is some equity upside if you play for a certain number of years and, you know, you could, they meet some hurdles.
You couldn't have a salary cap then.
Why?
How would you basically getting paid twice? You're getting paid by the franchise on the side.
But but the equity is included. So the growth of the equity is outside the salary cap. But they're taking some of their payment in equity. So it's not and, it's all.
I don't know about that. I feel like you're double dipping. Because then you basically that doesn't count as part of the cap. Oh, why don't just get rid of the cap then?
Because you can have the.
Well, you can pay them one. You can pay them $1. You can pay them $1 in the cap and give them share in the. Like, what is.
No, so if you're. Hear me out. For the sake of the math, let's say the Stroke's worth $100 million.
Yeah.
And you need to pay Travis $1 million. And yep. It's inside the cap. You pay him $500 in cash and $500 in equity.
Yeah.
And it goes into the cap as $1 million. It's pretty simple.
But yeah, if it goes into the cap,
in 5 years' time,
yeah,
okay, no problem. In 5 years' time, that might be
that's okay.
That $500,000 might be worth $2.5 million.
Yeah, but you can't then use that extra $500 inside the salary cap to get another player or whatever it turns out to be. I'm more with you on.
You can also give them the option to buy in. So you say, pay me $1 million, and I will also buy personally because I've done really well out of cricket $1 million worth of shares.
Yep.
And so now you're fully aligned for a great experience at the Adelaide Oval, him playing and not going to the PSL for half a season because they're offering him more money. You can see the benefit of aligning that incentive deeply.
David, last one here. Love the pod. I wish you could quit your day jobs and make a daily show. Maybe we can privatise the podcast. When you speak to Todd Greenberg, I want to know if he'll receive a bonus or some payout if the BBL sells.
I will let you I'm fascinated to the answer to that.
We'll ask him next week. We're back here on the ABC Cricket Podcast. More listener questions. We love those too. If you've got any for Todd, hit us up during the week. ABC Cricket Podcast at abc.net.au.
You can Kenny from Darlinghurst might put a couple of straight through on the email line, you reckon?
You can also find that email address, by the way, through the show notes, wherever you get this podcast of ours. Teddy, lovely to chop it up with you again. It's been a busy time for you. Have another little week off and I'll chat to you on a fortnight.
Thanks, Corb. Great work. Keep the good fight going.